Hello, and welcome to episode 49 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Schreffler. This week on the show, I'm joined by Dan Krynas. Dan is an instructional coach out of Connecticut, and also the host of the Leader of Learning Podcast. Dan and I are connected through Voxer and Twitter, and from the things I've heard him say in both places, I knew he'd be a great addition to the show. Dan and I talk about the impact of politics has on education, both internal politics and government politics. We also talk about being connected educator, podcasting, student voice, the Parkland shootings. We kind of go all over the place, and it's a really good conversation. So, sit back and enjoy episode 49 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Dan Krynas. All right, guys. Welcome to the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Schreffler. And today I am joined by fellow podcaster and really just a really enjoyable guy. I listen to his podcast and I really enjoy it. And so I'm excited to be able to introduce my audience to the wonderful Dan Krynas. How you doing, man?
I'm great, Brad. Thanks for having me. Really excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you here. You know, I listen to your show, The Leader of Learning, every week, and I really enjoy it, even though it's not really my, you know, I wouldn't call myself a leader in learning necessarily. I don't know, maybe I am, but I get a lot of interesting ideas and concepts from your show. So I really appreciate that, and I'm glad to have your voice on here. And for my audience who doesn't know you, could you just do a little intro of yourself and...
Yeah, I will. First of all, I want to say thank you for listening to the show. And since you listen to the show, I'm sure you've heard me say before that, you know, I definitely believe strongly that educational leadership can be practiced by anyone, regardless of their title or the role that they're in or the position that they're in. So, I would say, don't hesitate to think of yourself as a leader in education and a leader of learning. But, I'm Dan Krynas. Like you said, I host the show Leader of Learning. I'm a middle school instructional coach, about 12 years. I think I'm finishing up year 12 of my career. I started teaching in the New York City school system in the Bronx and then jumped ship. And now I'm at a small urban district in Connecticut. And, let's see. Last year I was named an ASCD emerging leader. I am a well-connected educator at this point. Starting to get out there and do a little speaking and presenting at some different conferences here and there. But, you know, at the end of the day, I really pride myself on the whole educational leadership thing, which has led me even into being a doctoral student now studying educational leadership. So, that's what I bring to the table.
Yeah, that's great. You know, and as soon as I said that I wouldn't call myself a leader, I knew you were going to call me out on it too. Like as soon as I said it, I was like, dang.
We definitely are. And listen, and I'm a fan of your show too. And I think that, to be honest, not only are you a leader in the podcast space, but I think that, one of the ways that you've helped lead a little bit more recently too is I know that Parkland affected you tremendously and you've not only had, episodes about it on your show, but you've referred back to it several times. And I know that affected you and I know that has inspired you to even do some leading, even if it's just making mention of it and drawing light and trying to find some solutions on your show. So I applaud you for that.
Thanks, man. No, I appreciate that. It is, it definitely sent a portion of my show in a direction I didn't really think I would go. And it has, lit a fire under me in a lot of ways and freed my speaking on a lot of things that I normally wouldn't bring up. So it has been an interesting twist.
And actually, one of the similarities that you and I share, other than just being tremendous podcasters and leaders of learning, is that I actually don't live very far from Newtown, Connecticut. And of course, Newtown suffered a tremendous tragedy in a school shooting a handful of years ago. I wasn't working in Connecticut at the time. I was teaching in the Bronx, like I said. But, you know, living just a couple of towns over, you know, of course it sends shockwaves through you and, you're like, oh my God, I'm so close. And unfortunately, we did know one of the teachers who was killed in that tragedy. But even if you don't, that it hits so home, that it is so close to home, literally, proximity wise, it has to affect you, you know, really deeply.
It does. It's it affects you emotionally, obviously. Like, there's the emotional of, you know, lives lost and the connections of sort of the, this is my profession and people like me. But I think there's for me at least, there's a pervasiveness to it, that it is something I'm always thinking about now, and not in a, like, how would I get out of this room kind of way, which is important as well. As teachers, we need to consider our exit routes sometimes, but more in a, are other people thinking about this? Do they realize the connections between this and all the other things we deal with? And, you know, it's interesting to me. It kind of just is always, it's kind of constantly in the forefront of my mind at this point in a different kind of way than it has been in the past.
Yeah, I hear that. And, it's definitely a tough, not only a tough tragedy, but it's just a tough issue to deal with. And like you said, you never really know kind of where it is in people's minds, you know, whether it's up toward the front or way, way in the back. Like, is this going to happen? And if it does, what do I do? And how do I prepare? And yeah, it's tough. And this is not the way that I thought we were going to start the conversation.
But, no, not me either. Definitely
actually,
not.
No, it's funny. I hadn't really thought about that before, but yeah, we sort of have that in common, because, you know, just living so close to it, it does something to you. It definitely does.
It does. I want to, man. All right.
Yeah, you can't really transition off of that.
We're just going to no transition, just cut, move. All right, moving on. So I want to go back a little bit on what something you said. You said middle school instructional coach. Do you have a focus in that instructional coaching, or is it sort of a generic coaching role? How does that work where you're at?
That's a good question. It's very generic. So I'm in a small school. I think that helps. The fact that I basically am just one instructional coach for a whole school. But when I say a whole school, I guess I'm only really talking about maybe 25, 26 certified teachers that I help support. And even though it's in all different subject areas, it's a small, close knit kind of community of us at my school. And so, I don't really find it to be overwhelming or like so much to handle. When I first started, I was worried, I guess is the best way I could put it, that here I am, a former ELA teacher and reading interventionist, and now I'm going to have to help support teachers who are teaching in a foreign language or science and math and, you know, just subjects that I wasn't really familiar with. But at the end of the day, good teaching is good teaching, regardless of what subject area you're in. And it took me a little while, but I definitely am comfortable working with teachers in all content areas.
Yeah, I experienced very much the same thing. I when I went into the coaching role, it was as primarily a digital coach, but I had the same thought, like, I don't know how to teach math. I hate math. How do I help a math teacher learn how to use technology if I don't know what they do every day? But you're right. At the end of the day, the content is not the king. It's the strategies and the instructional techniques. And I have never had that more clearly shown to me than if you ever walk into a foreign language class and you can still clearly see great instruction, even though you literally can't understand a word they're saying.
Yeah, no, that's true. And, you know, I think, like, you and I both we're big fans of educational technology, and I think that helped me get my foot in the door, so to speak, with some teachers. My principal created this position. Nobody at my school was the instructional coach before I was. And, it's been a little tricky, I'll be honest, to kind of create the role. But one of the things that helped, I believe, is that my principal, when he hired me or brought me on as the coach, he said, I really want you to focus on two areas that go hand in hand without a doubt. One, was we were in our, I think we were going into our second year of a one-to-one initiative where our students had, laptops, And the first year didn't work out that well for lots of different reasons, but we wanted the second year to go great. And he said, I really think you could offer a lot in terms of helping the teachers get their students to use these devices more and more. And secondly, really, we're looking for you to help ramp up the level of engagement and the rigor and use the technology to be able to do that. So, you know, like we've already said, it doesn't matter what subject area you're in, what content you're teaching. Good teaching is good teaching, and using instructional technologies for whatever subject area is a really great way to go at this point, because that's where the kids are at, and that's where they can connect with their own learning and make their learning relevant to life beyond the four walls of their classrooms and their schools. And it made a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's nice. It's a good thing to have an administration that supports a role like that, then gives you the freedom to build the role the way you think's appropriate. I think that's really nice, and you're lucky to have that.
I agree. Every once in a while, I think it's a little too much freedom, but I do, at the end of the day, I deeply believe that the administrators in my building and especially my superintendent really trust me to just do some great work, and whether that's centered around and based on technology and ed tech kind of stuff and new tools, then so be it. And if it's more, I don't want to say traditional, but if it's a little bit more, you know, less techy and more rooted in some more interpersonal learning experiences, then so be it as well. And I'd like to think that what I bring to the table is a nice balance and a nice mix of both of those things, really.
You know, I feel like there's a good portion of my audience who are instructors, classroom instructors, and would like to get into a more instructional coach role. I feel like that's something I hear a lot from listeners and on Twitter and everything else. So how does that path look for you? You said you're just an ELA teacher, you know, English teacher, and then now how do you come into this position where you're getting to build out the instructional coach role you wanted to have, basically?
Let me start by saying that there are definitely people out there who do not mind working, you know, having their students be the adults in the building, and other people, it's just really not for them. I tell people all the time, as a matter of fact, I know that you were on his show not too long ago, but I got to speak with Jethro Jones on the Transformative Principal podcast a little while back. And one of the things I said to him was, I think instructional coaching is the sweetest gig out there in all of education. And the reason I say that is because I don't have necessarily those really difficult classroom responsibilities, the grading and the paperwork and the report cards and parent phone calls, things like that, that bog down classroom teachers. I also don't have the responsibilities and the accountability of being a school administrator. So it is a little bit different. But it's not easy sometimes dealing with the adults in the building. So I know you asked me kind of how I got into it. I really do love what I do. I guess I got into it because even though I hadn't been at this school for too long, I was there for I guess about a year and a half at that point. My principal came in and he wanted to create this role of instructional coach. And at that point, I had experienced quite a bit of success with the students that I was working with in my intervention classroom, and the principal kind of recognized not only that I was having a lot of success, or my students were having a lot of success, but also he knew that I was really good with the educational technologies, and I knew I had a lot of tricks up my sleeve, you know, when it came to different tools to use, and he just thought I'd be perfect for a role like this. And you know, it might have been a little bit of being in the right place at the right time, but I think that advice that I would give to classroom teachers or people who are aspiring to become coaches, definitely first and foremost, you have to show success in your own classroom when it comes to your students' performance. But I would say start to emerge, if you haven't already, as a leader among your colleagues. Maybe step up to be like a team leader or a grade level leader, or run some PD sessions, or organize some kind of you know, after school or weekend, take some teachers to an ed camp. I actually did that. It was great. I got five or six of my colleagues from around the district last year to come to an ed camp with me, and they loved it. And I just think those kind of experiences are really important to, quote unquote, get your foot in the door.
Yeah, I agree. And a lot of that echoes how I came into my position of already being a leader in the school. And when the position became available, I was that name that they went to.
You just admitted that you were a leader. You just admitted that you were a leader
in
the building.
Oh, I didn't mean to say that. Oh, dang it. and then the one last thing I wanted to ask is how do you get from that to the podcast? Where does the podcast fit in your vision of yourself and what it is you do?
So I think the podcast for me got started for two reasons, really. One, I think I recognized that I was kind of at the point in my career where I wanted to start giving back and sharing more and doing it in my own kind of way. And so the second reason, I guess, I went the podcast route is not only did it combine my slight experience and brief career, if you want to call it that, in broadcast journalism with my passion for education, but also I'm a doctoral student at this point, and there's only so much of my time to go around after work and my family. I got two kids, 7 and 4 years old, and I said, you know, I want to share. I want to put out content. I'm already doing so much reading and writing for my doctoral courses. Like I can't do blogging every week or every couple of weeks. So I just, not that podcasting is extremely easy and not that it doesn't take up some of your time, but, for me, it's more comfortable. It's a medium that I can connect with. I like listening to, podcasts and audiobooks and all that stuff. I like learning that way. And so it just, I don't know, it seemed like a natural fit.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah, and it's funny because it takes me significantly less time to write a blog than it does to make a podcast episode, because I tend to be a first draft writer, one quick read through and go, yeah, good enough. But yet I cannot bring myself to blog regularly either. And yet I will never miss a podcast week because I have to get a show out. Like that's a priority. So I feel like even though blogs almost always take me less time, I know the amount of time a podcast is going to take me for sure. It is going to take me this long to record and this long to edit, and I've got it good to go. So, I get your point. It is a different medium for some people. It might be easier in some ways. So I see what you're saying for sure.
Yeah, and you know, I strategically keep my podcast episodes relatively short so that not only doesn't it take too long to actually interview my guests, but it also does not take very long to edit the episodes and then publish them every 2 weeks. And then, you know, I used to commute, like I said, to New York City. That was a little over an hour each way. Now I'm going about 40 to 45 minutes each way. So you're talking almost an hour and a half in the car every day. And listening to podcasts is one way that not only do I fill my time and entertain myself in the car on my commute, but, you know, develop myself as well. It's a really cool way to get your PD on the go. And so, you know, as a consumer of podcasts now for a little while, I just figured like, hey, let me try and get into that space. And so far, so good. It's been quite the ride.
Yeah, I agree. As we said before we started recording, this is the first episode of the second year of my show. So I totally agree with the ride. It is quite the journey being a podcaster. It is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dan, the beginning of this has taken a turn and turns I did not expect, but as is always the case on my show, we do have three questions that I would like to get to drive our discussion. And as I know you do listen to my show, I assume that you're at least somewhat prepared for these. So,
yeah, I gotta be honest.
Given them some thought.
I have, yeah, I gotta be honest. I've listened before, so I can't like go into a Brad Schaeffler interview without knowing what you're gonna ask, but I try not to like plan out my answers too much.
Good, I appreciate that. That makes me happy. I worry about as the show gets more and more episodes in and people tend to listen ahead of time that some of that magic of surprise is lost. Because I actually, when I'm editing, I like the silence after the question as much as I like the answers themselves.
And I love your format. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying anything about the three questions, the same questions that you ask everybody. But I have been burned on my show before by at least one guest where I gave out the questions ahead of time, and I won't tell you what guest it was, and I won't really say too much more about it. But you can, I literally had listeners of the show who could tell that it just didn't sound authentic and genuine, and I felt bad, and I don't know. I mean, the guest kind of did it to themselves, but at the same time, I was like, maybe I could have gone about that a little differently. So, yeah, I want to sound nice and genuine.
Well, it's a fine line, right? Because like most guests do want to know ahead of time what you're going to ask. Like, what are we going to talk about? What are the questions? And I always kind of say, your choice is to listen or don't know the questions in advance.
Yeah, except then when you give out the questions ahead of time and the person like literally scripts out their answers and it sounds like they're reading off a teleprompter. Anyway, I digress.
Yeah, I agree. It's a fine line there. Well, let's get to it. My first question of all my guests, of course, is what is the biggest problem facing education today?
All right. So this is one, obviously, like I said, I gave some thought to, but I'm going to kind of give a blanket statement, a very general statement that we could probably dive into a little bit further. But I'm going to say that the biggest problem facing education right now, or really for a long time, is just, I think, politics in general. And I say that for so many reasons, and I'm not even trying to take shots at our illustrious president or secretary of education. I just I see it on a small scale too. And one of the craziest differences, not that I didn't expect this, but like I left New York City schools after my, I was teaching for about 7.5 years, one of the largest school districts in the country, if not the world. And then I went to a very small district. We have like 1,400 students in our whole district. It's probably the size of your school.
And it's about half the size of my school.
Half the size. Yeah. Yeah. So really small district, and the politics are so different. So I like was not that I wasn't ready for it. I just didn't, I couldn't really fathom it. And so I don't know. The reason I say politics is just because, so many people, I'm mostly talking about public schools here, but because public schools are public, so many people think that they could have a say in what goes on, and maybe they do, maybe they don't, maybe they have a right to have a say, but it complicates things to no end.
Okay. I like that answer. I do want to dive into this for sure. So, when you say politics, do you literally mean the political machine, as in the elected officials who preside over a school district, or do you mean the more internal politics of favoritism or something more like that? Which one do you really mean or are thinking about in your head?
Yes.
Okay.
So, all right. So, but I guess both. I think that, when it comes to politics in terms of, let's say, I've heard people on your show before talk about like testing, for example. When it comes to standardized tests or just standards in general, Common Core standards or NGSS, whatever, it might not work for everyone, but yet that's what our politicians have said. The Common Core standards, to my knowledge, were originally not necessarily created by, but they were adopted by the governors of each state who adopted them. And I don't know how many states are even left, but I know Connecticut is one of them. And I don't know. I'm kind of tired of it, to be honest. I shouldn't say that. I don't mind terribly the Common Core standards. I just hate the tests.
Yeah, and I think, in my perspective, if you take Common Core, for example, and in Florida, we're not Common Core. We have Florida state standards, but they are Common Core plus cursive. That's the only difference. We added cursive back in elementary school and then left all the other standards exactly the same. But
We basically have the same thing, but I think in my area, in my state at least, it's not the standards that are the problem. It's the implementation that are the issue, because the standards were developed by people in education. They were adopted and implemented by politicians who don't have a background in education. And I, in my eyes, that is where we really start to run into problems, is things can seem like a good idea, but then people who don't really know all the ins and outs of the system try to put them in place, and that doesn't always work.
Yeah, you, I couldn't have said it better myself. I think that that's a lot of where I was going with that statement about politics kind of ruining education at this point. And then you also asked about sort of those, you know, that microcosm politic kind of thing that happens, you know, internally, let's say. Like, I'm going to just put it out there. I've been certified and an aspiring administrator now for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. And I believe that politics are maybe the reason why I haven't quite reached that next level or next step in my career. And I'd like to think it's not me. Maybe there are things I could do differently, like when I'm interviewing for jobs or something. I don't know. But I think that sometimes there are just some weird politics that happen, whether it's a large district or a really small district like the one I'm in now. And sometimes it's a little bit tough. And I think just in general, when politics blur the lines of true education and really, really doing what's right for students, things get really tricky. And I'm not going to go all the way out on a limb and say that happens more often than not, but I think it still happens too often.
And actually, that's going to lead to the other thing I wanted to ask you more about. And one of the things you said in there is, by the nature of it being public, so many people think they have a say, and maybe they do. And what's interesting to me about that is, and this wasn't where I was originally going to take it, but it's interesting to me that our educational system should be for the students, and yet the students have no voice in the political system. And I wonder if that is one of the places that, I don't know how you fix that, because in most cases they're not old enough to vote in any kind of real way, but how often do students have a say in the decisions that are being made at a district or state level?
That's a good question. I have seen times where student representatives will serve on the Board of Ed. I'm pretty sure that happens in the town that I live in, not the town that I work in or the city that I work in. But yeah, you're right. I think that there are far too few opportunities, for students of any age to truly have a voice in, you know, not just like what should go on in the school, but just like policy in general. On a small scale, we had something like that happen at, I work at the middle school in my district. At the high school, our football and baseball fields are being renovated as we speak. And, there was not debate. They weren't going to be able to hold the high school graduation at my high school. And so I think a tremendous opportunity that the superintendent agreed to take, which was, let's listen to the students about what they want. And they were actually, before some things fell through, and now the graduation's back at the high school. It's weird. But they were going to hold it at like a neighboring town. But the point of the moral of the story is that the students were the ones who really drove that, that decision making and voting process to say, look, it's our graduation, and we want to be able to be the ones to determine where it is and what the logistics are. And my superintendent was great about giving them that opportunity.
That's good. But I don't know that I would say that is the norm, at least not in my experience. And I don't think I would call that the norm from what I've heard in other parts of the country either.
Well, and it doesn't necessarily mean that students are actually getting to have a voice in actual policy, you know, educational policy, you know, where determining where to hold a graduation ceremony is a lot different from like, what kind of courses are we going to offer in our school, and how are we going to bring our instruction into the 21st century and all that. But, it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Huh. How do we fix the politics problem? How do we fix the fact that the politics often don't work in the favor of students. What do we do about it?
Well, I think we've answered that a little bit already, is to try and include the student voice a little bit more. And I can't really say that we want to drown out the other voices, because public education is public, and parents want to say, and of course teachers and administrators and those darn politicians. But I at the end of the day, and I know it sounds cliche, but at the end of the day, I wish that people, really adults, really stepped back and said, is this the right thing for the students? And I know it sounds simple, and again, it sounds cliche, but it's so true.
Yeah, I think that's a great sentiment. I don't have anything negative against that. That's perfect. And so I'm going to just roll right into my second question, because I think you capped that one off nicely for us. My second question, of course, is, what is something you're doing that you wish all teachers would do?
I think that if you, and I'm saying you, I guess, speaking to like your listeners, if you are not a connected educator, what are you waiting for? I think one of the things that I have done over the last two and a half years of my career is the best thing that I've ever done in my career, which is to get connected on social media. Twitter is huge. Twitter is tremendous professional development and networking and all sorts of amazing educational and career networking opportunities. Voxer is an amazing tool, amazing app to connect with other educators. When I became an instructional coach, and I alluded to this a little bit before, I was really nervous that all of a sudden here I was, I stepped out of my reading intervention classroom one day, and now I'm going to have to start coaching teachers of all different content areas. And I was like, I'm going to have to kind of do something here to gain some credibility, like some street cred with my colleagues, if they're going to like take me seriously and understand and appreciate what it is that I can bring to the table here. And that's what I did. I sought opportunities and connections through Twitter and through Voxer. And, I think it was around February of 2016, if I'm not mistaken, is when I got onto Voxer, and I got introduced to an amazing, amazing group of educators called EduMatch. And seriously, my life and my career and the trajectory of both of those have never been the same since. So I think that definitely one of the things that I do that I love and that has just meant so much to me that I think everyone should do is become a connected educator. Get connected with other educators from across the country and maybe even across the world.
Yeah, obviously I agree with you. I love that. And you're right. It's amazing how much it opens your eyes in so many genuinely profound ways. I distinctly remember personally when I started using my Twitter presence for education and getting connected with other educators. And it was when I was teaching ninth grade English, and it was around the middle of that first year teaching ninth grade English. And by fourth quarter, my entire teaching style was drastically different than it had been the rest of the year. Because I had just been enlightened, it felt like, by so many new ideas. And I felt like I had to change everything I was doing, because all of what I was doing was wrong. And I don't necessarily think everyone should throw out everything they do for the entire fourth quarter. I probably went a little too extreme, but it's almost that profound of an experience, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think back to 2016 school year, but for example, I said I got involved in the EduMatch group on Voxer first in, it's around February 2016. Like by the end of that school year, I was in a social studies class, sixth grade social studies classroom it was right at the end of the school year in like the middle of June. And I'm bringing students on virtual field trips by using the Aurasma app and getting them into augmented reality. And it was, just learning about different techniques and different tools and what other people are doing, bouncing ideas off of each other. It's amazing. And actually, a couple of months ago, I co-led a webinar about, instructional coaching. And the woman that I led the webinar with, she and I had some very different opinions about what mentorship meant. To me though, that is mentorship. I think that reaching out to a network of people through Twitter or through Voxer, and when I say a network of people, I mean like a close network of people, not people who are merely, I mean, everyone's kind of like an acquaintance, but like people who you know well enough to actually use them as a sounding board and to pick their brains about things and get feedback even from them. I mean, like you and I are in a Voxer group and Twitter chats about podcasting, and you know, we'll bounce ideas off each other and we'll tell each other what we think. And I don't think anyone's ever really too harsh, but you know, some critiquing goes on, and like it's all well and good. You know, that's part of the professional growth opportunity and experience. But I definitely think that getting connected not only broadens your horizon in terms of your reach and knowing so many more people, but it definitely opens your mind to all these things that are going on in the world of education, in other schools and in other classrooms that you might not even know about already.
Absolutely, I agree. It's interesting because you kind of touched on another point of it, and that's that you need to have those people you're close enough with for sounding board purposes. And I think sometimes when I talk about connected education, and I've done sessions on Twitter before, and I'll talk about, oh, this is Twitter and here's what you should follow, and here's the chats to check out and stuff. I think the natural inclination is at first to just kind of watch and let it all flow by. And that's great. It's a good starting point, and I know there's plenty of people that are okay with that. But I think you're right that at some point those connections need to become a little deeper than that. And that requires a two-way street. Like it needs to be more than just acquaintances, like you said, or more than just someone you listen to. You need to be able to have those two-way connections. And that takes that smaller, more tight-knit group. So that's almost like diversifying. It's one thing to watch the stream go by, but you need a buddy to go out in the canoe with from time to time too. That was weird. I like metaphors, apparently. It's been becoming a thing recently on my show.
Yeah, no, that was a good one. You know, there are plenty of people, in the Twitterverse and connected educators who I only just follow, right? But I wouldn't necessarily think of them as like being in my close network of people. I think I shared this with you a little while back. At one point I had switched the logo, the art on my podcast, and I temporarily switched it to a design that actually received some fairly harsh criticism. And, it was members of my connected communities and closer knit, PLN, Professional Learning Network, that were like, look, I don't know if you want to go with that one. And we had some pretty serious debate going on Voxer one weekend about, enlighten your audience about what was going on. It was an image of a superhero, let's say. It was a silhouette, so you couldn't see any facial features or anything. It was just a silhouette of someone wearing a cape. And it really did catch a lot of flack or I caught a lot of flack for it. And it was a very interesting debate that went on about whether or not educators could or should be compared to or portrayed as superheroes. It went all over the place. One guy was like, I'm a huge comic fan and I think it's fine. And another guy was like, you're making educators out to have superpowers and they don't, they're just human. It was crazy. But I guess my point is, sometimes, like you said, you kind of need that two-way, that feedback, that constructive criticism, and that those real, actual, genuine, professional conversations, whether or not sometimes they're easy to hear, That's a different story, but, you know, they're helpful regardless.
Yeah. And I mean, we've seen a lot of examples in media recently where companies, for example, have released something without running it by other people, other human beings. And it goes out and everybody's like, whoa, you can't publish that. That's insane. And there's one guy in the back going, but I thought it was totally cool. I didn't realize that you couldn't do that. You know, I'm thinking about the Gap model. The kid in the sweatshirt comes to mind.
Oh, I do remember that.
If they had a PLN, they wouldn't have released that. You know what I mean? Like, somebody would have looked at that. And I think we have the same thing in education. I can certainly think back on things I did in my classroom that failed miserably. And I will tell a story like, okay, well, this is what I thought I was going to do. And as soon as I get to that part, the other teacher's just laughing. Like, yeah, that was never going to work. I'm like, oh, well, I thought it would. I guess I probably should have asked you in advance.
And you know what? Actually, I didn't mention this, but one of the other reasons that I answered the question about what I do that I think everyone else should do, and I said becoming connected, you just kind of alluded to it. I think teacher isolation, which I could have actually said for that first question about what's the biggest problem facing education too, because I think that's a huge problem. And, you know, like you just said, if you try something in your classroom and it completely fails, like maybe you could have bounce that idea off of a colleague or had them, hey, God forbid you invite another adult into your classroom to actually watch what you're doing. Like, people get all crazy about having other adults in their room watching them, but, you know, invite someone in and have them, maybe it's me, maybe it's a coach, you know, and maybe it's just your grade level partner down the hall. I don't know who it is, but, teacher isolation, I think is a problem still. And I don't know about where you are, but, I see it sometimes. Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's not. It depends on who the teacher is and the culture in the building. But, I wish that would go away a little bit more too.
Yeah, I agree. And it does. It combats the seven issue. You're right. It is isolating for sure. And even, you know, we all think so differently that you may be able to, I remember times where I got along socially with all of my peers and coworkers and the people that were teaching what I taught, but I didn't necessarily agree with them instructionally.
Actually, it's funny you say that. When I taught in New York City schools, the first school I taught at, there were two ELA teachers and two math teachers. And so I was one ELA teacher and there was another ELA teacher on my grade level. I've never really had that since, cause I've been in smaller schools. But the other ELA teacher and I taught very, very differently. And there was a really interesting dynamic. We were also very different, ages. She was, much further along in her career. That's a very politically correct way of saying she was, you know, different age. And I was newer at my career and we did things really differently. And, there was also like this, so we weren't like learning from each other directly, but we were definitely taking note of the things that each other were doing and the way that we were doing it and what worked and what didn't. And what was really neat about that was I felt this even at the time, like we were kind of competing against each other, like this unspoken, unwritten competition, between us. But at the same time, we were definitely like playing off of each other. And, even though we didn't have the same students, It was just a really cool way of both competing and also partnering at the same time. So, we were pretty good about, you know, not isolating ourselves. We planned some curricula together, and actually we came up with this amazing, unit that I was always so proud of, about journalism. You know, I was a journalism student, and her father was actually a well-known, respected, journalist in his time. And so it was really cool to put something like that together. But, yeah, we had that thing going, and there was something about us that even though we were so different, our styles were different, our ages were different, our approach was just, you know, here I was like the techie guy, and she like, I got a smart board right away when my school started adding smart boards. She was still good with the chalkboard. You know, that's how we worked it, but it was great actually.
Yeah, it takes I've been lucky enough to be in that scenario as well, where me and two of the other same grade English teachers we all planned everything together, but then we would each take our own spin on it in the classroom. And we had that same kind of competitive, but friendly. And like, we all got along really well socially, but we would be kind of competitive about our scores. Our scores would come out for a common exam and we'd be like, all right, who did well? Who got what? But the step we always had that I felt like is missing in a lot of those scenarios, then that builds a lot of stress, is we always said, okay, why did your kids get that? Cause I want my kids to get that. Like, why did your kids understand that part of it? Mine didn't get it. What did you do differently? And then we would start to break down the reflective practice. And I think so often that's what people worry about with that connection part and that co-planning and that working together, is they worry about administration coming in and comparing them to the other person through some kind of test score, which doesn't show a full picture. And I think if we can let that stress of it go, we can build the relationships like you're talking about.
Yeah, and it's something you just said there is like a thorn in my side, you know, using student standardized assessment data to compare teachers or even to get any sort of real sense of what a teacher is doing is that's a slippery slope. But yeah, you know, whether it's meeting with teachers, observing teachers, just chatting it up with teachers, you know, I think again, that connection piece is huge. Especially if the administration to teacher relationship is kind of strained, you need those colleagues to not just bounce ideas off of, but just be there for each other and support each other.
Yeah. So connected inside your building and outside your building, that's where you're at. And I think it's perfect. I think it's great.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, man, I got one more for you. And believe it or not, we're coming up on time here. This has been flying by. All right, so my last question for you is, who is the best teacher you've ever had?
So this is actually the hardest question of them all for me. And I'm not exactly sure why. It's probably because I don't remember a ton of my teachers. Like, Not that I don't remember them. I mean, I remember their names and I remember what they look like and I kind of remember what I learned in their classes, but not too many that I really, really connected with that well. Before I tell you who I would consider to be my favorite teacher, I'm going to shout out a couple others. I had two really amazing music teachers in high school. Mrs. Bruno was my chorus teacher and Mr. Stockberger, we called him Stock, was my band teacher. And the reason why I say they were amazing was because I, at that time, was extremely serious about my music. I went to college for music, or music education initially. And so they were just really, no pun intended, they were very instrumental, to my earlier life as a teenager and young adult.
Before you go on to your next one, though, you mentioned this actually on one of your podcasts and I just remembered it. You played the trumpet, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yep.
Yeah. I'm a lifelong trumpet player myself. I went all through, and I also started college as a music ed major and it didn't stick. So
that's cool.
I heard you say that on one of your podcasts and I was like, wow, that's crazy. Like, who knew?
Yeah. Yeah. That's totally me. I was really serious about my trumpet playing there for a while and even got a little partial scholarship to school, studied music ed, and then I got on the radio, you know, go figure, and that's I fell in love with that, and I was like, oh, I want to be a radio producer, but that didn't last too long, and then I went back to education, and I'm much happier for it. So those were my two amazing music teachers in high school. I also had a couple of really cool teachers in middle school. One was Miss Foreman and the other Mrs. Fox. And the reason I'm shouting them out on here actually, and I don't know whether they'll hear this or not, but I've already mentioned how I believe being a connected educator is extremely, extremely important. I've recently gotten back in touch with these two amazing middle school teachers of mine because they're on Twitter, and their district that they work in, which is the one that I went to growing up, they're doing some amazing things. And these two former teachers of mine are tweeting out the amazing things that they and their district are doing. And I'm proud of them. And it's funny because I was their student but now just being as connected as I am and as into education and educational leadership as I am, it's just really cool to see that they are still in the game, you know?
That's cool.
Yeah. It's really cool. And so, all right. My favorite teacher was a lot of people's least favorite teacher. He was a very polarizing figure. You either hated him or you loved him. Fortunately for me, I loved him and he loved me. And that's why I say he was my favorite teacher. His name was Mr. Height. I don't know, to be honest with you, whether Mr. Height is still with us. But I had him. He was my senior year, so 12th grade English teacher. And this guy, like I said, you either hated him or you loved him, and he had kind of that same, it was a two-way street. It was kind of clear that there were students he didn't like and there were students he did. And I'm proud to say that I was one that he did. And because of that, he just taught me so much about writing, and he was very giving and generous of his time and his efforts. My wife and I have actually been together since high school. We weren't married back then, of course, but, we started dating back then, and my wife did not have him as a teacher. And he, because he was also, a professor at the college level, he would help students write their college, application essays. He would come, he lived a little ways away, but he would come to our town at the public library on the weekends, and he'd sit there and he would tutor kids and help them with their essays. And like, my wife never took him as had him as a teacher, but she was able to go and get help from him with her college applications. And he was just, I just thought he was great. Again, he was not everyone's cup of tea, but for me, he was just really, really helpful. And just believed in me a lot, I guess. And so, that's why I would say he was my favorite.
Yeah, that's cool when you have that teacher that you can point to for so many reasons, right? For all the things they do above and beyond. That's just awesome.
I think one way that I would put it, I guess the best way I could describe kind of the relationship that we had was, he became, for that year that I had him as a teacher, one of my biggest fans. You know, after my parents and my grandfather at the time, who really supported my passion for music and my drive to want to really succeed in music and music education. My teacher, Mr. Height, he was always like that too. And I remember he gave us an assignment that year. It was the longest paper that I had ever had to write to that point in my life. Now it's like, whatever. I'm a doctoral student. I'm writing all the time. But we had to do this like thesis paper. And I chose to write it, I'll never forget, I chose to write it on music therapy, because it was kind of a new sort of field that not a lot of people knew about, and I think still don't maybe, but I thought it was really interesting, and he just really supported me, not just in that assignment, but just like learning about music and pursuing my passions, and I just, yeah, he was just a big fan of mine, so. I appreciated him for that.
It's cool. And you know, it's that connection, right? It's that connection so far above and beyond the classroom, so far above and beyond the content and the curriculum that we all remember about those phenomenal teachers. It's never the math. It's never the English that we remember. It's the connection.
Well, yeah, you're right. I would never ever disagree with that. But actually, sometimes I think about it and I think that even though it's sort of like outside the curriculum and outside of instructional things, you know, at the end of the day, becoming a fan of your students and finding ways to bring their out of school passions and habits and interests into the classroom is a really, it will separate good teachers from great teachers too. And I've seen that and like Mr. Height did for me, by allowing me to research and write about music therapy because it was just something that I was really interested in. You know, he found a way to bring my interest into the curriculum. And I think, that's one of the things definitely that I appreciated him for. And I think that that's one of the things, like I said, that will really bring you from good to great as a classroom teacher.
I couldn't agree more, Dan. And I think it's a perfect place to end this off. We've been going almost an hour and it's flown by, but I really do appreciate it. It has been a great talk and I really appreciate your time. How can my audience find you if they'd like to reach out to you?
All right. Well, I've already mentioned Leader of Learning podcast. So the website is just leaderoflearning.com. And really, you could find everything on there from my blog to how to connect with me, to reach out to me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at D Krienes, DKRIENESS. Voxer, same thing, D Krienes. And definitely get connected.
Absolutely. Dan, I really appreciate your time, man. Thank you so much.
Brad, thanks a lot, man. It was a pleasure. It was a really great conversation, and I appreciate you having me. Thanks so much.
Yep, thank you. Have a great night. Dan, thank you so much for coming on the show and for the extra 30 or 40 minutes we chatted afterwards until I accidentally kicked off my internet. It was so much fun talking to you. If you want to connect with Dan, you can find him on Twitter. He's at D Krienes. And you can also find his podcast at leaderoflearning.com. Links to both are in the show notes. I highly recommend his show no matter what your role is. Like he said in the beginning, anyone can be a leader of learning regardless of title. If you have questions or comments about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Brad Schriffler on both. I love to hear from you there. That's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or the feedback page on my website gives you options for feedback as well, which you can find at bradschriffler.com/feedback. Until next week, think about who does have a say in education. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio. Your voice is right here.